and welcome to Minute 74 of the Great Escape Minute, the daily podcast where we dig into the Great Escape 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Luke Allen, host of the Love Rosie podcast and writer-director of the upcoming short film, Reduced to Clear. Welcome to the show, Luke.
Thanks for having me on. Yeah, it's great to be here.
It's a great movie, and you told me that you enjoyed it, so I figured I would invite you to come talk about it a little bit. So hopefully you'll have some interesting things to say about it
as we discuss this. I did realize as soon as I put it on the other day, I have seen it before, but so much in my head has got it mixed up and blended with Escape to Victory. I don't know whether that's something that's come up by other guests on your show.
That has never come up, and that is, these movies are, in my opinion, black and white, completely different.
People have said that to me before, but then other people have agreed. So, like, it seems, yeah.
I've never heard that comparison before, but that's fine. We're looking for diverse opinions here anyway.
So there were certain scenes I was expecting where I was like, oh, it's where they end in this. And I was like, no, they football is not involved at all.
Which is there's no weird. Sylvester Stallone, there's no Michael Caine, and there's definitely no Pelé.
No, and it's so I will apologize if I get occasional comments on the film wrong to the listeners. That first of all, I watched the wrong minutes, and second of all, I rewatched the film in the background this week. I'm mid exam season, and this is a nice bit of escapism. No pun intended. But it's. I'm assuming that there'll be points where I'll get a character's name wrong or something. But just as I will with my exams, I'm going to ramble and hope that something's worthwhile and gets me some marks.
There you go. Episode 74 begins with Roger and Sedgwick pulling the rope frantically and goes all the way till we get to see Cavendish begin to carol. As we were discussing yesterday, basically we saw that Willie was in a cave-in. Danny ran or crawled down the tunnel in order to pull him out as quickly as possible and start dragging him back in order to try to save him. So this minute opens up with we see Roger and Sedgwick sitting in the way station. I think it's the first way station because you can see the ladder going up. So yes, it's the very first way station. And they begin to pull the rope in order for the trolley to come back with Willie on board. So they pull and they're actually pulling a lot. I mean, these are not short distances. You know, I would say it's got to be at least 50 feet, if not more, between each of these way stations, you know, when they're pulling things down. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it definitely felt like quite a large distance. And it's quite, I did love with kind of all these sequences how easy it is to picture the geography of everything in your own head. Like, it's almost so clear instantly from watching it, just geographically where everything is. Yeah. I know that's probably a very... It's what you hope from most films, but an awful lot of films get really confused in that, especially this kind of golden era thing I'm imagining, when you've got... when pretty much everything is a set.
Yeah.
Location-wise.
Yeah. Location-wise, they do this... they set up this movie really, really well. You don't have to see the entire camp, but they let you see so many locations within the camp that you get an idea of where everything is and the relative distance between the different places, you know, and even this is a perfect example. I mean, they've told us before that the length of the whole tunnel is eventually supposed to be 335 feet. We all know that, you know, anyone who's seen the movie knows that number is incorrect. But, you know, we're not going to discuss that at this point because that'll come up much later, numerous times. But the idea is that you have these way stations along the way in order to give them, I guess, room to breathe at every particular, you know, at a certain distance. We don't know the distance. They never mention how far it is between each of these way stations. My assumption is it's somewhere between 50 and 100 feet.
Yeah, I think that makes the most sense. Is like, because obviously it needs to be a considerable distance apart, but also you don't want to risk getting stuck for too long in one place, or you don't. Yeah, it's you want it to be easy enough to go one at a time and to be able to rescue when needs be.
Right, and also you need to make it that when they eventually go, you know, when they eventually have the escape, so you need to have everything move smoothly also, because you don't want to have too much of a backlog in one particular place. You want to have enough room to move people back and forth, and if you have all these different way stations, then you can have let's say, 5 or maybe even 10 people crammed into the way station waiting to go forward. I mean, they never even show that.
I think similarly, if they were being chased through this sort of area, if they were being caught right at the start, it would be quite a hindrance for those chasing them as well to kind of be getting out and onto the next one. And then, like, it kind of slows them down, especially those who probably don't know it too well.
Right. All they have to do is just pull out a gun and shoot. And then it's, you know, the German guards won't have a problem after that point. You know, if they are chasing them down the tunnel like this. Basically, Cedric pulls Willie off of the trolley. You see he's completely covered in dirt, his whole face and head, and you see he's having trouble breathing, and then Roger takes him and starts cleaning all this dirt out of his mouth, and then thankfully Danny at this point brings over a canteen to try to help him, you know, spit out whatever dirt has gotten into his mouth, you know, along the way also. It's just pretty funny the way that they're taking care of him at this point.
Yeah.
He looks like a little kid that they're taking care of. You know, a kid that fell in the sandbox or whatever it is.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. And it's just so kind of fascinating overall, kind of aesthetically as a film. And what I will say is the version you sent over, I think, is a much better kind of remaster than the version I was watching.
No, it's a Criterion. It's the Criterion Collection. Obviously, yeah. It doesn't get better than that.
No, I think I've got a really kind of old DVD of it, because it was going from watching it on my TV to kind of watching these minutes. I was just like, oh, it's I can see what's going on now.
It's not as grainy.
Yeah.
There isn't as much dirt on the screen, you know.
Yeah.
Which, you know, Willie is just spit when he's spitting out the water and dirt. So he's, you know, the screen gets a little clogged up, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, I like the way that he spits really far. You know, that amount of water that they give him. And then it's great because, like, Roger opens Willie's mouth at some point where it looks like he's like a dentist, you know, just pulling his mouth as open, as wide as possible in order to look inside. I mean, it's my question is why is he doing that? You know, like, why would you open his mouth that much? He just, you know, just took a sip of water or a chug of water and spit it out. You know, you don't have to look. He is an adult. You can let him, you know, get rid of whatever dirt he needs to on his own.
Yeah. And whilst we only get like a little bit of it here, I've got to comment on the score. I think the score is amazing.
Yes.
And it's so fascinating to me how films get away with having that motif, which I don't think we get this minute actually, but having that sort of motif, which we all know, and it not getting annoying. Like it must be so difficult, because I mean I found it similarly with some of the with the films I've done on my shows, especially Love Rosie and About Time. They have like a certain little motif in the score that is reused over and over and over again, but doesn't annoy you, where it so easily could.
Well, because first of all, Elmer Bernstein is an amazing composer, and I'm really shocked that he didn't get more accolades for the work that he did in this movie, because the score is unbelievable.
Just so iconic. Like,
yes.
I think the number
of
films...
Well, now it's iconic, but I'm talking about when it came out in 1963.
Yeah, even back then, yeah.
You know, why it wouldn't have been... You know, why people didn't praise it at the time for what he did. Because, the as you said, the theme stays the same throughout the entire movie, but it changes, because sometimes he's using different instruments to evoke different feelings about different things. Sometimes it's, you know, it sounds like he's using different percussions or things like that, just to change things around a little bit. But it's, as you said, it's still the same, but it sounds very different each time.
Yeah, which is, when looking at like some of the shows that I've been doing at the moment, like Ralph Wegenmayer has a certain motif in Love Rosie, which I'm imagining pretty much all of your listeners will have not seen or heard of Love Rosie, because it's a very small scale film.
Well, now they have the opportunity to go back and check it out.
Yeah, definitely do. It's a beautiful, beautiful rom-com, but there's a certain thing in that which is kind of a do 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 do, and especially when we're making notes and stuff and watching it for the show, I'm like, this score's happening again, and every time I hear it, it makes me think I want to watch the entire film all the way through. And I think Bernstein does the same here, that it's like the moment I hear that, it makes me, like, even to the point of like hearing it at the end of the film when I just finished watching it, it made me go, I think I might watch this again, which I couldn't because I had to go to college for an exam. But it just brings so much joy and instantly makes you want to watch it, which is, I think, brilliant.
Well, that's what you essentially want to do. You know, you want to have a score, you want to have a movie that people are going to finish watching and they're going to be inspired to want to watch it again.
Yeah, there's definitely two levels of composer as well, because similarly, I think there's certain greatness in the composers who you don't notice, who make you feel things without you realizing they're making you feel things. Like, that's a separate art, and unfortunately they're never going to get as much appreciation or credit for it because they go unnoticed. But I think Bernstein, for the iconic scores, which still, like, they don't, you know, separate you, take you out of the film. But I think there is definitely two levels to score composing.
Right. If anyone's interested in the Criterion Collection, they actually have a commentary where Bernstein is one of the people on the commentary, so you can hear his thoughts on the score. I mean, obviously, it's not throughout the entire movie. It's different sections where he discusses things. But one of the things he also says is the important thing as a composer is knowing what scenes don't need music, and the lack of music says something also.
Yes, and I've started to realize that from a filmmaking perspective as well. It's like I made a film a couple of years ago called Unstable, had a brilliant composer, a guy called Ethan O'Mahony, working on that with me. And I sent him every scene, like pretty much like we did it a scene at a time. So I sent him every scene as it was edited and was like, composer score for this, composer score for this. And I love the film. People love the music from the film, but also it's very music heavy. And so I'm now moving on to this current project I'm doing. And it's like there's these areas where there isn't music, and it's so much more effective to just the feeling of the silence, either the comfort of silence or the lack of it, the awkwardness. And so, yeah, I definitely think that there is a lot of credit to go to not using music. I mean, like, look at Buffy, for example, like a massive Buffy fan. The score of Buffy is great. And yet the episode The Body uses no music whatsoever. And because of how used to the music you are, the lack of music is so emotionally powerful that it's wonderful.
Yeah, completely. So moving along in the minute. So now we actually get a little
bit of
dialogue.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure where I went on to Buffy from
Great
Escape.
Okay. That's perfectly okay. You'd be surprised where some of these conversations have gone. It's fine. I think that's part of the point of doing a Movies by Minute podcast, where you can get off onto tangents and then afterwards you look at it and you say, wow, how did I get to that thing? And then you just bring yourself back.
It definitely, I know it is on mine, but whenever I'm guesting, I'm like, I don't know whether these are the guests that want to draw it back into the point or allow the tangents. And sometimes even when you cut the tangents, it just improves. Having had the tangent almost improves the rapport between host and guest, or between hosts. Like,
completely agree. So basically, at this point, we actually get a little bit of criticism here from Willie. He says to Roger, "You're going to have to shore up the whole bloody tunnel," which is actually great, because earlier on, when Roger was making the plan, he basically said that they're going to skip most of the shoring up, and now we actually get to see, you know, that he actually made a mistake earlier by making that decision, and now we can understand what needs to be done in order to correct that mistake.
Yeah.
And then he basically says, well, you got to do all 335 feet of it, which, again, goes back to what we were saying before. You know, everyone's got this number wrong at this point. You know, Cavendish starts off. Yeah, you know, I'm going to once again give a shout-out to Jay Kluwit, who was the guest on the second week. You know, he pointed out the fact that Cavendish is the character who causes the most trouble out of anything. And if you want to find a villain in this movie, it's Cavendish, because he's the one who doesn't do the proper survey and gets the 20 feet wrong. Sorry about the spoiler for anyone who doesn't know what we're talking about yet. Obviously, he's also the one who makes the noise and falls on his package, which eventually alerts the guards to the fact that there is an escape going on. So I just like the fact that they referenced the 335 feet right now.
Yeah.
At this point, Danny then also gives his criticism, and he says, you know, four times today, boom. You know, it's nice that he does a little sound effect there to show, you know, that the type of sound that happens when you get an avalanche of dirt falling on top of you.
Yeah.
You know, the question that I have is what is the norm? Like, what do they expect when they're digging? You know, how often during the day do they expect that there's going to be cave-ins? You know, obviously, in an ideal situation, they're not going to have any. But you know, they're not professionals, and they're not using professional methods. You know, it's all
yeah, and nothing ad hoc. Nothing about what they've had has expressed that it's ideal at all.
Correct. Exactly.
Which yeah, it's so.
So when he's complaining about four times, is that because usually it only happens twice, or is he saying usually it doesn't happen at all?
Yeah.
Or is he saying usually it happens three times and this time it happened four? You know, there's no way.
But I do like with stuff like that as well in film that where it almost establishes conversations that you've not heard and instantly yes. It's like world building, which is correct. Just so great because it's so easy as a writer to do that, to just throw in like the exposition and be like, here's every scene. And I guess in a way it's the wonderful thing about even if you write it and then delete that conversation afterwards, it's like not everything that happens in these characters' lives is ever going to be everything that you see as a viewer. And I think that it shows great screenwriting to be able to subtly imply other exchanges.
Yeah. Then Danny continues with his complaints and he says, well, if we're going to keep going through this, we're never going to be able to get through. This isn't going to work. And he says, we need more wood. I love Charles Bronson's performance in this movie.
Mm.
You know, he plays the immigrant, you know, Polish character quite well. You know, he's quite agitated at this point where, you know, we just need you to get us more wood. And, you know, so at this point, Roger now needs to figure out how he's going to do that. And then Sedgwick gets his say. And he basically says, well, that's a lot of timber. Is there a way that you can get it? And at this point, Roger promises that he will get it. There's no way about it. We're going to have to get it. And he says, I'll put Henley on it. And the new man we got this morning. Now, obviously, he's going to put Henley on it because Henley's a scrounger. That's his job.
Yeah.
You know, Henley's the guy who, when you need something, you go to. He's your Red from Shawshank. You know, he's the guy that when you need something, you know who you're going to go to. And he's gonna follow through with whatever he needs. You know, he was able to get the pickaxe. He was able to get the camera. Earlier this week, we discussed that. You know, there's all these different things that he's able to. Obviously, he got the wallet also. So he's the guy.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, the donor is like a typical character among like props film theory.
Yes.
Is like, and that's exactly who he is, preparing, you know, the characters for their quest per se. And I think it is. You know, it's obviously one of many, and I'm not going to try and, like, assign all the characters to props film theory because I'm not going to pretend that I have done that much research into the film and that my A-level film knowledge is quite as good as it should be in places. But I think it is fascinating sometimes almost seeing these character types in some of their earliest forms in a way. It's just lovely. And I with you talking about everyone's role, I do love the fact that in the end credits, it's both their name and their role.
Yes. Yeah, they do that really well. Because we've discussed this numerous times, that this feels like a heist movie.
Yes.
You know, that everyone has their set job that they have to take care of. And that's what this movie basically establishes, as you said, in the end credits, where each of them are given their roles. You know,
I came out of this and decided I want to watch Italian Job. Like, there were hints at it where I was like, I want to go watch Italian Job now. So, yeah, there's definitely heist movie vibes.
Yeah, completely. And I love the way that he says that he's going to put Henley on it and the new man we got this morning. You know, and, you know, anyone who saw, you know, the minutes up until now, so we know who that new man is. That new man is actually Hiltz. Which it's funny that he is a character who apparently nobody knows.
Yeah.
You know, he's made so many escape attempts. He's been in different prison camps along the way. Obviously, Goff knows him. No one else apparently knows him but Goff. But still, when you look at it, they still refer to him as the new man. So it's pretty funny because he's new to the X organization. That's what they're getting at here, basically.
Hmm. Yeah.
Then we basically finish off the minute with a few seconds of Cavendish, as we discussed earlier. you know, about. Actually, one second, I just want to say one other thing beforehand. As the scene ends, Roger then basically says to Willie, okay, I'll take care of it. And then he, like, tussles Willie's hair, which again goes back to the point where Roger must feel like he's a father figure here. You know,
yeah, it gave me, their relationship gave me real, like, Of Mice and Men vibes. And I'm trying to, I'm trying to remember the other character's name.
No, I don't know if I would go that far, like, because he's not like Lenny.
Yeah, you know, it's not, well, it wasn't to that extreme, but there were certain elements with, like, how he was looking after him where I was like, this really does feel like how they were looking after them. And I've completely forgotten the other character in Of Mice and Men's name, but it's, there were little hints of it where I was, it was just a vague kind of reminding. But not enough for me to have made a comment unless you'd brought it up. But
no, I mean, the fact is it just it's a very strange way for him to touch him.
Yeah,
you know, that's the point that I wanted to really make here. And then we get that final few seconds where we get to see Cavendish begin his rendition of the first day of on the 12 days of Christmas. You know, he starts with his singing on the first day of Christmas, and you know, then it gets cut off. People will have to come back tomorrow to actually understand where that goes. Is there anything else that you wanted to discuss about, first of all, about this minute?
Nothing else specifically about this minute, but I have a couple of...
Okay, well, what about the movie on a whole? What else would you like to
discuss? So anyone who's heard me on other shows would know my fascination with classification, censorship, and all of that stuff. So this was... a thing which I wanted to look into, which was how the film was originally rated in the UK. And so, first of all, it was originally rated U in 1963, which I think is basically equivalent of your G. And it's now rated PG for mild violence, language, and injury detail. But the BBFC website, BBFC, to those who don't know, is the British Board of Film Classification, have given a little breakdown, which I love. I got one of my films rated by them at one point, and the breakdown as to why it fits a certain category is just lovely and fascinating. And one of the many reasons in which I prefer the way our BBFC do things over the MPAA. But I also don't think many people are going to be arguing with me and defending the MPAA either. But it's...
yeah, probably not.
So violence, they say, several people are shot, all without visible blood or injury detail. One of the shootings leaves a dead man hanging limply from barbed wire. A group of prisoners is massacred, but the actual killings occur off screen. Obviously cut things out if you don't want, like, the spoilers for your later minutes.
No, that's fine. I'm assuming that most people have seen this. So,
it being a true story as well, like, it's, yeah. Language, there's occasional use of mild bad language.
Once again, being a true story, but those the most of the things that happen here are not based on truth. So, you know, Ives is not a not based on a true character or a true event. Mm. He is based on a true character. There was a character named Piglet who Ives is modeled after. You know, the stories are very different between what they do in this movie and what happened in the real escape.
So, yeah, there's occasional use of mild bad language, including bloody. And then injury detail. We see a large smudge of blood on a man's face after a plane crash. Another man is shown with small bloody cuts on his face and arms. Occasional scenes of mild suspense featuring people in danger. And several characters are also shown smoking as a kind of, like, extra note.
Ooh.
But it does fascinate me, actually, this was ever rated U. Because, like, just some of the violence, like, it's only just post-Hays Code. So, like, some of this is quite strong to be classified for all audiences in 1963.
Right. Okay. That is very interesting. I believe that this is the type of movie that you can show to kids.
I think it is, you know, but not... I can't imagine so much.
Most people that I've spoken to have seen it when they were a kid. You know, I saw it when I was a kid. And the amount of violence in this movie is not... at a level where it's going to be scary for kids.
Yeah, it's very matter of fact, and it's not over the top. But I think almost it's mere presence. I could imagine early BBFC getting concerned by, but I don't know. It's I think it's a film that people definitely watch. I think I don't know whether it's the case in America, but like this film's on like every Christmas. It's not even really a Christmas movie, but it's on Christmas time every year.
Well, you know, Cavendish is
yeah,
singing
I mean, this
Christmas
scene specifically, right now, obviously, so. But I mean, like, yeah. Tonally throughout, I'd say this is on TV more over Christmas than what I would consider my favorite Christmas movie, being Lethal Weapon. That's not on as much over Christmas when it should be, because it's.
Die Hard is a better Christmas movie, in my opinion.
Agree to disagree.
Lethal Weapon is high up yeah. there. I do agree.
When it hits Christmas season, I do like I start with Lethal Weapon and I do like a slow progression into like the increasing Christmassiness. So I kind of start like mid-November with Lethal Weapon and then move up the Christmassiness scale because I'm stupidly organized like that. But it's yeah. It's fun. And listeners of my first podcast series, Please Be Seated, will know my fascination with the UK Christmas films, the Nativity franchise, about school kids doing nativity plays, and they're trashy and cringy and cheesy, but also some of the most lovely things I've ever watched. There's a random plug for a show that doesn't exist anymore. although I do.
It doesn't exist because it hasn't continued.
But we do. I'm thinking of bringing it back every Christmas just to go through those movies because I really like every year getting because there's like so many of these there's so many sequels every year. It's one of the most British films ever and everyone in Britain has seen it countless times, but I just love like inviting American podcasters to watch it and try and understand like where we get the joy out of it because it's just cheesy and it's almost entirely improvised by children. Like it's yeah.
Interesting.
But there was a random sense. Tangent, but there we go.
Another one, yeah. Which is fine. As I said, that's completely fine. So is there anything else you want to say about the movie?
I don't think so. Just overall, really enjoyed it. I think because I had it on more in the background, it did make me want to like properly try and sit down and watch it and dedicate full focus to it when I can. One of my notes was just about it being produced by United Artists, because obviously that was a company that was co-started by Charlie Chaplin. And that's interesting. But that was pretty much the extent of it, was I read United Artists and I was like, oh, Charlie Chaplin. But there's no...
Yeah, I don't think Charlie Chaplin... Did
no, I checked. I was like, did he have like a producer credit or anything? But no.
No. He was in, I think, Switzerland at the time, right?
Possibly, something yeah. Like my film history isn't as good as it should be. But yeah.
Right. All right, great. Do you want to tell people how they can get in touch
yeah,
with you?
Yeah, okay. So you can find me on Twitter at llama_bottle0. It's an old account. I made it when I was like 12, but that's my at now. Got it on 500 business cards, so it's sticking. You can find me on Instagram at thegingerluke, on Facebook at Luke Allen Film. Everything I do is over at lukeallen.co.uk. You can also find stuff that I do on like IMDb and Podchaser. Notably, the upcoming comedy film Reduced to Clear, which is a short film that I co-write and co-directing, filming in the future at this point, but will have filmed by the time you listen to this, which is kind of terrifying because I got a lot more pre-production to do. But it's we're shooting that in August and probably maybe we'll have a trailer out soon to the point you're listening. Maybe a couple of weeks from now we'll have something like that out. Who knows? It's just a very silly movie set in a thrift store about all things going wrong, featuring many familiar faces from British comedy that for most American listeners, you'll have no idea who they are, but just trust me there. Trust me, it's cool. And yeah, I think that's it. Thanks for having me on. My plugs are very long there. Feel free to trim and cut them.
No need to trim them at all. We want people to go there and just, you need to promote yourself also. That's fine. While you're going and looking at all of Luke's stuff, you can go rate, review, and subscribe on any podcatcher they might be using to listen to our show. You can send us an email, thegreatminute@gmail.com. Our Facebook group is The Cooler. Our website is thegreatescapeminute.com. And our Twitter account is greatescapemxm. So, until tomorrow, tally-ho!
Tally-ho!